BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Is sponsored by The Converging World, an organisation that aims to create a world where everyone has equal access to resources whilst minimising their impact on the planet. You can hear more about that in a special interview with Nicola Jones later on in the programme. You can also visit their website on theconvergingworld.org. Our guest in the studio tonight is Helen Richardson from the Bristol and Somerset Energy Efficiency Advice Centre. There's the second part of Tony Gosling's History of the Theatre of Bristol, the Jacob's Well Theatre Riots. Malcolm Greaves reads the second extract of Sided with Rosie by Laurie Lee, and Jeff is here with his What's On guide. Now it's over to Tony Gosling for the news.
Just one item from Private Eye this week. Inspector Knacker has been asked to investigate alleged financial irregularities in the ID department at Forest of Dean Council in Gloucestershire. The inquiry is believed to centre on invoices totalling £10,000, for which no record of any services provided can be found. Inspector Knacker may wish to speak to the council's former interim IT chief, Dr. Charles Omole, who is now in a similar role at the Equality and Human Rights Commission in London. Mr. Omole was interviewed for the job by Carmel Ahmed, the EHRC's communications supremo, formerly of The Observer. Ahmed told the Eye, "Charles came to us with exemplary references from the Forest of Dean and is doing an excellent job here. Neither he nor we have any idea what this is about because neither the council nor the police have contacted us so far." Outside work, Dr. Omole is founder of the Winnipeg Faith Bible Church and the author of a number of religious works, including The Secrets of Bible Wealth Transfer and Prosperity Unleashed, Praise the Lord.
Thank you, Tony Gosling, for that wonderful item of news. Now it's over to Matt Heap for his satirical look at life.
Hi, I'm Matt Heap, a fellow newcomer to Dialect Radio. For anyone who takes an interest in the world around them, it's very easy to become a little depressed, angry, or just plain old apathetic, given the negative edge to most news stories on the TV, radio, or in the papers. I'm at the beginning of a quest to try and find news stories from around the world which are interesting or funny, or just a little bit different from the ones you might hear on the mainstream current affairs. Already, I'm encouraged by the stories I've come across, and whilst they are too numerous to mention here, I hope that you'll be joining me in the forthcoming weeks in my quest for a sideways look at the news. One of the experiences I'd like to tell you about is the May Festival of Ideas, which Bristol has been hosting with debates and films covering everything from religion to politics, culture, science and the environment. One of these events was a homage to Ian Fleming, the creator of the James Bond character. Ben McIntyre, who has become a Bond expert since researching for his latest book, spoke knowledgeably about the man behind Bond. Apparently, whilst Fleming was knocking back enormous quantities of gin in his Jamaican writing retreat, he briefly flirted with the idea of calling his main character, wait for it, Peregrine Maltravers. What a lucky escape for our British hero. In the film they showed afterwards, Goldfinger, which came out in 1964, there is a famous scene in which Auric Goldfinger, the villain, dispenses with his secretary by painting her entire body with gold paint, after she betrays him. In the film, they explain that she has died from skin asphyxiation. Bond goes on to explain the professional dancers know to leave a small patch of skin at the base of the spine to allow the skin to breathe. Right, so let's have a little vote on this now. Could this happen for real? Hopefully you said no. It sounds ridiculous now, but in 1964 when they made the film, many believed this to be true, including the filmmakers, who ensured the actress Shirley Eaton had a 6-inch square of unpainted skin to allow her body to breathe. I still wouldn't recommend this at home, as there is no guarantees the paint won't be toxic, or simply stop your body from releasing heat properly. All this from a 20th century film. And now before I go, here is something you can try at home. If you place a glass on some scales and pour into that glass some liquid of your choosing, it doesn't matter what, the reading on the scales goes up, right? Okay, let's say you place your finger in the liquid without touching the sides. What will happen to the reading on the scales? Will it go up? Will it go down? Or will it stay the same? Listen in next week for the answer. Or, if you like, why not try it at home and see if you can come up with a reason for seeing what you see. And finally, my swan song story is that of a man in Australia who has been nominated for the 2008 Services to National Stereotype Awards after he was caught by police officers driving with a safety belt securely fastened around his case of beer, leaving his toddler to scramble around in the car completely unsecured. That's all from me, Matt Heap. Look forward to joining you next week with more titillating stories and ideas of satirical interest.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Coming up is a track from Fallen Angels called New Society. Fallen Angels, New Society. Now over to our studio guest, Helen Richardson from the Bristol Energy Efficiency Advice Centre.
We have in the studio tonight Helen Richardson from the Bristol and Somerset Energy Efficiency Advice Centre. Helen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So what organisation do you represent? Where are you based? How long have you been going for? Tell us a bit about your organisation.
Well, basically, I work for an organisation called the Centre for Sustainable Energy that's based in Bedminster, but my actual role is the manager of the Bristol and Somerset Energy Efficiency Advice Centre, which is just an advice centre within the Centre for Sustainable Energy. And the advice centre itself was the first set up as part of a national network, and that was set up in 1991 when actually there was only one member of staff actually manning it then.
So Bristol was ahead of the game at that point in time then?
Absolutely, and hopefully still too.
Good to hear, sir. Good to hear. So what's the kind of, give us an example, a flavour of the kind of activities that you get involved in.
We do a range of things. One of the main things is we have an advice line that's manned sort of Monday to Friday, 9 till 5, giving advice to the public on how they can save energy at home. But as well as that, we attend events. So last weekend we went to the Festival of Nature. We also deliver presentations and training as well.
Excellent. What's the most frequently asked questions that you remember from the Festival of Nature?
Well, it does vary, but specifically with the Festival of Nature, a lot of the inquiries that we got were based around more about renewable energy. We tend to find that it depends, obviously, on the type of event that we go to is what people ask. So other events that we'll attend in sort of smaller events, more community-led events, then we might get asked much more questions on grants for insulation and that type of thing. But generally, with Festival of Nature, it was renewables-based.
Okay. So it depends on how much disposable income people have.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, what the priority is for that person at the time, because obviously energy efficiency is the first stage that you need to look at for saving energy before you move on to the more expensive technologies, such as renewable energy.
Right. So are you given goals as an organisation?
We're set targets by our funders, the Energy Saving Trust, that we need to meet each year. And that's basically based on the number of people that we speak to and advise throughout the year. And that's given a carbon rating for each person that we speak to.
So what does that data suggest? What does it tell you about how well you're doing as an organisation and how well the public are doing in the transition?
I think as an organisation we're doing very well. Last year we had the most amount of inquiries out of the whole network, so nationally, which shows that in the southwest, specifically Somerset, Bristol and South Gloucestershire, we're finding that people really are interested and want to do their bit.
That's really good to hear. So how does what you're doing tie in at a national level then with the British government, and how are the British government kind of doing compared to other European countries with environmental targets?
Well, evidence shows that we are doing well at saving energy and obviously reducing our carbon emissions. There's still quite a long way to go, I would suggest. We have a target set by the government, which is part of the National Energy Efficiency Action Plan, which outlines that we need to, through residential savings, cut our carbon emissions by 31% by 2020. So at the moment, it looks like that by 2016, we will be able to meet 22% of that target through just insulation measures, having high efficiency condensing boilers and lighting. That's ensuring, though, that every single person does install those measures. So obviously, you can see that that's going to be quite a difficult thing to do, but not unachievable. However, to actually get to that full 31%, we would need to do a huge amount more, which would then need to look at hard-to-treat properties and looking more at incentives for renewable energy. So, yeah, a lot more needs to be done.
Good, good. Okay, next question. What do you think the barriers are to kind of achieving what we need to achieve in terms of the environment?
There's quite a range of barriers. I think, obviously, rising fuel prices, people are finding it harder and harder to pay their bills, which actually is we're finding then that people that are identified as living in fuel poverty is rising. Fuel poverty relates to anyone that spends more than or would spend more than 10% of their income on their fuel bills. So obviously that figure is rising and more needs to be done to tackle those issues. The other sort of barrier is around lack of awareness. There's still a lot in the media about climate change, but people are, I think, less aware of what they can actually do. Also possibly we could do with more grants for hard-to-treat properties, the ones that don't have cavity walls, so solid wall properties. And we're also finding that there's sort of an environmental overload sometimes within the media without actually getting to the householder level where they can look at their own emissions and how they can save energy.
So part of the battle then is getting the public to realise that there is something they can do, and some of those things are quite simple really and may not involve huge sums of money.
Absolutely. I mean, the easiest ways for us to tackle this problem is from what people can do at home, and those are very simple measures such as insulation, changing the light bulbs, which there are grants and discounts available to everyone for those things. And ultimately, as well as reducing our carbon emissions, I mean, we're really talking about helping people to save money as well. So it should be a win-win situation, really.
So the grants of things like insulation, do they include double glazing?
Unfortunately not at the moment. Basically, you can get the greatest savings from insulation as opposed to double glazing. You lose anything sort of around 30% of the heat from your home actually from your walls, but only probably about 5 to 10% through your windows, which is why the grants are focused firstly on the insulation measures.
So if I was a bit cash-strapped, but I wanted to do the right thing and I wanted to get a grant of insulation, I wanted to spend some money on insulating my home, what would the payback period be for insulation?
Well, it does vary and it depends what grants are available at the time. But on someone that would not necessarily be eligible for a government grant, so say they weren't in receipt of benefits, someone that did have the money to afford it, at the moment the price of sort of having cavity wall insulation on sort of the average three-bed semi is anything from £150 to £200. So with that, you should be able to save between £160 and £180 per year on having that cavity wall insulated. So you're looking at sort of 12 to 18 months to see the payback from that.
So naturally, you're concentrating on methods that have got a quick payback that people can see a very instant kind of benefit from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, just to finish, do you deal with energy conservation for businesses and offices, or is it just for housing?
We deal purely with the domestic market. However, there is the Carbon Trust that deals with any businesses. They have a website and a free phone number that you can call, and they'll be able to give assistance to any businesses.
I see. A little query of mine, I've often wondered. Most offices have some form of strip lighting. And there's a bit of a debate going on in the office at the moment as to whether it's better to turn that lighting off when it's not being used. And sometimes that will mean having it switched on and off several times within a day. Does that actually use more energy than just keeping the thing on?
I think generally there has been some sort of misconceptions about it. It does use slightly more energy when it is initially turned on, but really it will get that energy back within a few minutes. So we generally advise that you turn it off whenever you leave the room or don't need it
on. I should be taking that bit of advice back to the office tomorrow.
Great.
Just to finish then, if anyone is listening to this who thinks they want to kind of get involved, perhaps by having a career in this field, what would you recommend? What would be your suggestions for somebody who wanted to get involved in a career in environmental conservation?
Basically, I'd recommend if you just have a keen interest and from starting out, you try and do some voluntary work, then that will go a long way. Really having experience in the field will get you a lot further than just having, you know, your A-levels or a degree. I mean, ideally you'd have a degree in a related field and the experience, but really we're finding more and more that someone that really has a desire to be in this field and has the experience and is really keen to try and help people out as well will go really far in this area.
Do you have any contact numbers at all?
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone wanting to call our advice centre and find out information on how they can save energy at home needs to call 0800 512 012.
Thank you very much, Helen Richardson, for that.
You're
something
welcome.
We all need to think about.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Gosling reads us the third instalment of the History of the Theatre in Bristol, and this week's episode is called The Jacob's Well Theatre Riots. Over to Tony.
A man came to me at a fair and said, "If you've a poet's tongue, tumble up and chant the air that the stars of the morning sung." I'll pay for you if you sing it nice a penny piece. I answered flat, sixpence is the proper price for a ballad such as that. The story of the Bristol stage, from 1490 to 1925, serialised in 9 parts from the book of the same name by Miss M. Board. Part 3, The Jacobs Wells Theatre Riot. An amusing play has come down to us, which proved how Shakespeare was loved in the days of our primitive theatres. A young wife insisted on attending a performance of Romeo and Juliet, in spite of the entreaties of her relations. She had her desire, but had to leave the theatre before the play was over, and on the way home, as she crossed over Brandon Hill, she gave birth to a boy. She called him, of course, Romeo. The end of the little theatre in Jacob's Wells was a tragedy. There was a riot in sympathy with an imaginary grievance. The performance was interrupted. Rotten fruit was thrown at the players with the intent to do harm, and the noise of hissing and booing became deafening. Finally, the actors left the stage and, after some fighting, ejected the rioters from the theatre. This did not finish the affair, but they then climbed the slopes of Brandon Hill and flung missiles and stones onto the roof of the theatre, and the company was in some peril. Thus ended the history of this little house of dreams, but the memory of it lives on, a fragrant flower in the posy of dramatic art. The company removed to King Street in 1766. The little theatre in Jacob's Wells was opened under other management, but it did not seriously count as a dramatic house. The last performance held within its walls was a pantomime in 1779. About half a dozen famous names are associated with our first Bristol theatre. Macklin was much valued in Bristol. He began his theatrical life with Rich's company of Lilliputians. Thomas King was the original Sir Peter Teazle, which he played to Mrs. Abingdon's Lady Teazle. He was described as confined in power but a perfect actor. Hazlitt immortalised him in the following critique: his acting left a taste on the palate sharp and sweet like a quince, with an old, dark, rough, withered face like a sour apple, puckered up into a thousand wrinkles, with shrewd hurts and tart replies. King was 17 years old when he, like Ned Shuter, joined a band of strolling players as they travelled the Kentish barns. King went with the company to its new quarters in King Street and became manager. He retired in 1802. Of all Bristol actors, the most beloved was William Powell. When Garrick, suffering from temporary loss of popularity, went abroad, he left his principal parts in the hands of young Powell, Coleman being manager. Powell had been a clerk in the counting house of Sir Robert Ladbroke, the great banker. Garrick discovered Powell's ability at an amateur performance given at the Wood Street Debating Club in Temple Bar. He encouraged the young man to throw up his clerical position and go on the stage. In Garrick's absence, Powell carried all before him, and in fact became a serious rival to Garrick's greatness. He was described by a contemporary as tall and thin. His voice in tragedy moved all hearts. He was tremendously popular and became the fashionable rage in town. Davis writes of him, "Powell was an enthusiast in acting. He loved the practice of his profession to that extent that he cared not what number of parts, however different from each other, he was called upon to represent." On Garrick's return from abroad, Powell and Coleman left Drury Lane and went to Covent Garden. Powell acquired an interest in the management of the theatre. He was always very faithful to Coleman. Unfortunately, there was serious trouble between them and Garrick. Finally, Powell came to Bristol, where he became the talk of the town. It said his arrival started a theatrical mania which raged in Bristol. 5 years later, in 1769, Powell was foolish enough to lie naked on the grass after a cricket match. He naturally caught a chill, and on the Friday he died in the arms of Hannah Moore. She dearly loved him. She was playing Richard III at the Royal at the time, and he had just said the lines, "All of us have cause to wail the dimming of our shining star." When Powell's death was announced, poor Holland burst into tears as he tried to address the audience. He broke down completely and the performance ceased. Powell's burial service was read in the cathedral, where a tablet commemorates his memory. Mrs. Pritchard was called by Johnson an inspired idiot. She was famous as Rosalind and also as the Queen in Hamlet, which she played at Drury Lane. She retired in 1768, and at her last performance she played Lady Macbeth to Garrick's Macbeth. Mrs. Pritchard's daughter was the original Fanny in The Clandestine Marriage. She was a great friend of Hannah Moore's. Miss Hallam recalls a tragic story of Macklin's violent temper, for she was the daughter of a man with whom Macklin quarrelled, and in his mad rage blinded. Hallam died of the injury. Miss Hallam afterward married Mattox, the Covent Garden actor. Mrs. Green was Hippisley's daughter, and she took over management after her father's death. She went with the company to King Street. Five other actors have to be recorded: Richard Winstone, Clark, Mattox, Blake, and Palmer. Mr. Palmer was afterwards in joint manager of the Theatre Royal in King Street. They're all names that Bristol loves to remember and honour. We come now to the most glorious period of our theatrical history, the days of the theatre in King Street. But we will not anticipate, as each step brings a pleasant memory. It's good to record all we can of the place we love so well. The citizens, having met and selected the site for the new theatre and entered into the final arrangements, they were offered another site in Limekiln Lane. It's to their credit that they stood by their agreement and refused the second offer, though they thought the last site the better of the two. This house had a great tradition. Here lives the memory of men and women who gave their all for their ideal, their love of the beautiful. On November the 30th, 1764, the foundation stone was laid of the new theatre, and from its beginning the house was the centre of eager hopes and dreams. Few who saw the laying of the stone dreamed of the golden future, or thought they laid the foundation of one of the world's most famous theatres. The surroundings of the playhouse were fascinating. They still are, though their glory has departed. In those days, Queen's Square was the centre of fashion, and Prince's Street a wonder. It is still most beautiful, though, inhabited by ghosts instead of a fashionable world. The country, scarce held back by the city, seemed so near. Even in King Street, cocks crowed at dawn, and hens recorded each domestic triumph. The green trees gave comeliness. It is a fair dream, this, of our old city in the days of her beauty, more than a century ago. In those days, Clifton was a hamlet, and King Street was in the heart of town. The Puritans were greatly distressed at the project of the theatre in their midst, and made obstacle after obstacle, and a storm of protest arose. The quarrel raged until a company of citizens combined. 48 people subscribed £50 each towards the building fund. In return, the subscriber was given a silver token, or ticket, for admission. This gave them the right to seat at one performance for every play produced in the theatre. There are a few of these silver tickets still in Bristol. One is in the museum, and a photograph of this one forms the frontispiece of the little book. It is inserted by the kind permission of the curator of the museum and art gallery. The two citizens most concerned in the enterprise were Mr. Thomas Simmons, a solicitor, and Mr. Alexander Organ, who was sheriff in 1767 and mayor in 1787. Much loving care was lavished on the new building, and a careful inspection was made of the Metropolitan Theatres. They were also carefully measured, and the deputation returned with a ground plan, elevation, and section of Drury Lane House, to procure which they consulted and employed the ingenious carpenter Mr. Sanders. It is interesting to remark that Joseph Harford, brother of the Harford who bought Blaise Castle, was one of the subscribers. The theatre cost in all £5,000 and was finished in 18 months. Various patrons of art subscribed a further £1,400 and later another £1,000. They evidently got the idea of silver tickets from the Haymarket, who had a similar arrangement, but they issued two gold tickets also as a mark of special gratitude. The records give us the names of men who made the theatre. James Patey was the architect, Gilbert Davis the builder, Fooke the mason, and Franklin was the smith. The scenery was painted by Loughborough. The house was beautifully decorated by Michael Edkins under Mr. Simmons. Simmons was a fine painter. When Hogarth saw his sign over the Angel Inn in Redcliffe Street, he was delighted with it, and wished that the altarpiece at Redcliffe had been by the same hand. The theatre was executed by local artists, for craftsmen were artists in those days. Owing to a curious error, the stage was drawn on the plan 8 feet larger than the one at Drury Lane. The theatre accommodated 1,600 people, 750 in the boxes, 320 in the pit, and 530 in the gallery. On May the 30th, 1766, the theatre was opened under the management of Powell, Holland and Clark. There was a ground rent of £22. Garrick was present in the audience, and he also wrote a prologue and epilogue specially for the occasion. The play was Steele's Conscious Lovers, and followed by The Citizen, a farce. Thus began the history of Bristol Old Vic. That was part three of the story of the Bristol stage, 1490 to 1925, by Miss M. Board. Next week, part four, the opening of the Old Vic.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Intrepid reporter Anthea Page are about organisations which are helping to improve the lives of people in impoverished areas of the world. The first interview is with Nicola Jones from the Converging World organisation, which is using wind power in Tamil Nadu to help local communities worldwide. The second interview is with Rachel, an NGO worker originally from Bristol, who reports on relief work after the tsunami hit southern India.
I'm in the hub in Princes Street at the top of Bush House and beautiful views overlooking the cathedral. And I'm talking to...
Nicola Jones.
And what are we going to talk about?
Well, I'd love to talk about my passion, which is women's empowerment around the world, which includes the women in the West as well.
And this all started with Kofi Annan, did it?
Well, that's part of it. I've done a lot of speaking around women's issues, and I'm currently doing a master's in gender studies. And when I was speaking a lot about microcredit around 2003, 2004... Kofi Annan's statement of 2001 was very pertinent, and what he said, he was the United Nations Secretary General, and he basically acknowledged that women are a key driver, if not the primary driver, of development, i.e. Increasing access to resources and meeting the needs of the impoverished in what's called the developing world or the third world.
And you're particularly interested in networking, is that right, with women?
Well, I think that women across the world have so much to learn. I think it's a little bit of a fallacy that we've got it all in the West. And I do very much believe that in wanting to help, and I speak from my own very personal experience, is that I'm always a bit suspicious of myself and therefore of anyone really who wants to help others. If we haven't really taken a good look at saving ourselves first kind of thing. And it very much comes down to the sort of ethics of one's practice and one's work. And I think that we have to care for ourselves before we can care for others. So that's really what's guiding the work I'm doing with my master's now and the women's network that I'm establishing in August.
Yeah, and you're interested in women's networks around the world.
Yes, right? Absolutely. What I'd like to do is to encourage men and women in the West to join a network which is affiliated with the Converging World, another organisation that I work with, about which I can say a little bit more. And the idea is to support women's initiatives around the world, but responsibly. I think there's a great tendency to commoditise women, particularly now they've been seen as a key driver to development. What we don't need is using women to achieve even more economic growth in the way it's currently being done, with little regard really to people and the environment. So when I say responsible, I think that there are various ways in which we must look at the assumptions we make in the West in trying to help others. And so what's really needed is to listen to those others, to understand what that listening involves. And again, I think that's perhaps a topic for another time, because listening is not as easy as it might appear to be. And really to find ways to enable those people to make their own decisions so that there's true empowerment at the grassroots level.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm. So can you tell us a bit about the Converging World, how that helps people in Tamil Nadu?
Yes, I'd be delighted to. The Converging World is a charity. It's a national charity. It was set up 2 years ago. And effectively, it creates social justice through investment in renewable energy. It's an absolutely fascinating model, and it's quite complex. So it really needs people to sit down and take the time to want to understand the complexity. We live in an increasingly complex world, and simple solutions are rarely capable of addressing that complexity. So the model is unique, and it's based on a principle of convergence. And the way in which we work with SCAD, Social Change and Development in Tamil Nadu, is to fund wind turbines in that area and to enable part of the profits to be paid to people in SCAD in recognition, really, of the contribution they're making to enabling the generation of renewable clean energy for the benefit of the whole world. Albeit the turbines are in India, they benefit the entire world, because climate change is a global issue. It doesn't matter where the turbines are. And so whilst this is a thriving organisation, it's been running for about 20 years, founded by an amazing couple, Cletus and Amelie Babu. And they have a substantial turnover. The extra money we'll be able to give them will enable them to grow that bit faster. They're currently benefiting about 400,000 people. Yeah. And there's a substantial element of women's empowerment going on there with the 2,500 women self-help groups.
Because it's the largest wind turbine in Southeast Asia, isn't it?
It's a 6,000 acre farm. Yeah. You've actually seen it?
Yeah, in Tamil Nadu.
Have you?
Yeah. It's colossal.
And how many wind turbines would you estimate were there at the time? Can you?
Well, I don't know. There was thousands.
As far as you could see?
Yeah.
Well, we're building the first two, thanks to the founder, one of the founders of the Converging World. The first two will be constructed by July.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we will fund a further 15 over the next 2 years. So yeah. Really, that's where the drive is now, to raise funds. And this women's network that I'm establishing in August is very much part of that, is to raise funds through people appreciating their carbon usage,
yeah.
To put the money into the wind turbines and then generate money for not just India, but there's also a return to that,
all over the
network,
world. All over
and
the
then
world
we can brilliant. Reinvest in other women's projects around the world.
Brilliant. So is there a website where people can access information?
Well, the Converging World is theconvergingworld.org.
Yeah.
The network model, which is going to enable people to make payments, that's going to be available in August, hence the launch of this network in August, and we're going to have a launch in Bristol and in London.
Oh, so if people log on to that web, is there a website?
That website isn't available, that isn't yet, because the software is being developed as we speak, and it'll be ready for August.
So where can people find out about the launch in Bristol?
Well, right now, what would be terrific is, actually, if I give you my email address, I'd be delighted to talk to anybody who wants to participate in what's called the Converging World Women of the World Network, and it very much includes men as well as women. In fact, my first member, because I've started doing a bit of offline, networking is a person from Tamil Nadu. Kartik works here in London, and he offered to be the first consortium member, which is fantastic. So my email address is Nicola, Nicola, at theconvergingworld.org.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm originally from Bristol, but I now work in Middlesex for a relief and development organisation called Tear Fund, and I'm here in Kanyakumari, the very southernmost tip of mainland India, visiting some of our projects here.
So can you tell us what happened in the tsunami?
Yes, the Boxing Day tsunami of 2004 struck the coast of mainland India from Chennai right down the eastern side to here at Kanyakumari. The communities here are mainly fishing communities, and the tsunami struck on the Sunday, and the communities here are strongly Catholic, so most of them were actually here at church, so they weren't out at sea fishing. So in one way that was great, but another way it meant that all of their livelihood assets were destroyed because they were lying on the beach. So they lost their boats, their nets, their motors and so on. So although there wasn't a significant loss of life in this particular area, people were struggling to survive after the tsunami because they had no means to make ends meet.
The boats that were smashed, were those the catamarans?
Yeah, they have a variety of boats here, which they use according to season. So there are the wooden catamarans, which are basically three big logs of teak wood lashed together with rope and look very, very unsafe. And also a number of people would have had fibre boats.
I noticed there was the Salvation Army symbol on some of the houses. Can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, well, the organisation I work for is called Tear Fund, and we work through local partner organisations here in India. And one of the partner organisations we work with here in Kanyakumari is the Salvation Army. They're based locally, And so they were able to respond very, very quickly, actually, on the day of the tsunami. They were called to bring their ambulance to come and help evacuate what they thought were going to be a few injured people, but actually it turned out to be much more than that. So they quite early on had an introduction into the communities and were asked to help more. So they did a number of things like relief, giving out food and clothes and shelter in the immediate aftermath of the tsunami. But they stayed on also to help reconstruct the communities, and that included giving fishing boats and nets and repairing motors and then building houses as well. And so people have now moved into their new permanent houses away from the coastline.
Can you tell us now about the new housing that's been built?
The new housing has been built according to government blueprints, and it incorporates a number of design features that will hopefully help communities to withstand other disasters that may come along in the future, such as earthquakes and cyclones. The properties are all built as detached units, as it were. And they all have an external staircase and a flat roof. So that will enable people to have an escape. They can go up on their roof if another tsunami comes. But it also means that they can extend their houses. They're all built to be able to have a second story added onto the top. And it also gives them a flat area on the top of the house for them to dry their fish. As you walk around the villages or on the beach, you can see people just lay out the fish to dry in the sunshine, and it attracts flies and the dogs and everything else sniffing around. But if they can dry the fish up on the roof, then it's slightly more hygienic for them.
So this is a new step in hygiene, isn't it?
That's right, and all of the houses have incorporated a toilet, and for some of the people this will be the first time they've actually had their own toilet.
But they've also got a bit of land, haven't they?
They all have what they call kitchen gardens, and a number of the partners have also passed on to them saplings so they can grow coconut trees, guava trees, mango trees. So yes, they've got an opportunity to enhance their diet, and obviously it gives them a cleaner, healthier environment in which to live and bring up their children.
So can you tell us about the women's role?
The women's role is very much to support the husbands. So the husbands will go out fishing, and you'll see on the beach about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, the boats come back, the men offload the fish, and at that point the women take over. So they then come, take the fish from the men, and they go and sell it in the local markets. A number of organisations here are forming what they call self-help groups, or SHGs, and it's very much also a government-supported scheme throughout India. So they're looking at getting groups of women together in each community, up to about 20 women, and they form groups initially to save money. So each lady will perhaps save 50 rupees, that's probably about 70 pence, 50 rupees a week or possibly a month, and each lady saves that money in a shared account. And when they've got quite a bit of capital saved, then one lady can use that money, borrow it as a loan, and use it perhaps to pay for a health bill that's come in, a doctor's bill, or to pay for a festival in the family. And by doing it that way, it saves them having to borrow money from a money lender at extortionate interest rates. And then obviously once the group dynamics have been formed, then a lot of people look at doing micro-enterprise, so small businesses. So they'll teach them a particular skill, and then they will try and help them access a market to be able to sell products and get a source of income independent of their husbands. It would also be year-round income for the family, because obviously fishing is dependent on the weather and the different seasons.
Tell us about the extra tuition.
Sure. Well, here in India, generally the government will allocate, in the government schools at least, two teachers for 70 pupils, but they take no account of the ages of the children. So in any particular class, you will have all different ages thrown together, and that means children have very little individual teaching for their particular standard. So what one of our partner organisations, Discipleship Centre, is doing evening tuition classes in the evenings in the villages. And they've recruited local volunteers from the villages, so they are working as tutors in the village between 6:30 and 9 o'clock in the evenings, and they divide the children up into age-wise groupings, and then they teach the same as they teach in school, so they follow the government curriculum, but it means the children get much more individual attention.
So can you tell us about the village hall?
The village hall has been built where our partners have also built houses. It's used for a number of purposes. One of them is to be a gathering place, say, for the self-help groups to meet and also perhaps to make things, to be a sort of production centre. In other places, it's also equipped as an early warning centre. So it's equipped with a megaphone so that if there's another disaster approaching, the whole community can be warned. And it's generally a place of safety, so it's located in a place away from the sea where people can be safe if another tsunami comes.
Yes, although the houses are simple, they've all got a television.
Oh, very much, yes. They're very great lovers of Bollywood films out here.
And how many villages altogether have you set up? Is it nine?
One partner is working in nine villages here in Kanya Kimari district, and the Salvation Army is working in another two. So we're covering altogether about 11 villages in Kanya Kimari district.
And how many houses in each district, roughly?
Altogether, Discipleship Centre are building just about 700 houses here in Kanya Kimari and also in Cuddalore district, which is just sort of south of Chennai. And Salvation Army are building 90 houses.
They get a bathroom, kitchen?
A kitchen, small kitchen.
And bedroom?
Yes.
And a roof terrace?
Yes, and a veranda at the front so that they can meet as a community and have that as their little space.
Yeah. And a little kitchen garden for, yes. Was it £2,000?
Around about £2,000, yeah, per house.
Well, it's very nice to hear that the tsunami money went into such a positive way.
Yes, it's great. As you go around the communities, you can really see how something that was so awful actually has now produced something that's quite beautiful and lovely.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And now for our second instalment of Sided with Rosie, as read by Malcolm Grieve.
Sided with Rosie, by Laurie Lee. Now I measured that first growing year by the widening fields that became visible to me, the new tricks of dressing and getting about, with which I became gradually endowed. I could open the kitchen door by screwing myself into a ball and leaping and banging the latch with my fist. I could climb into the high bed by using the ironwork as a ladder. I could whistle, but I couldn't lace my shoes. Life became a series of experiments which brought grief or the rewards of accomplishment, a pondering of patterns and mysteries in the house, while time hung golden and suspended, and one's body, from leaping and climbing, took on the rigid insanity of an insect, petrified as it were for hours together, breathing and watching. Watching the grains of dust fall in the sunny room, following an ant from its cradle to the grave, going over the knots in the bedroom ceiling, knots that ran like negroes in the dusk of dawn or moved stealthily from board to board, but which settled again in the wax light of day, no more monstrous than fossils in coal. These knots on the bedroom ceiling were the whole range of a world, and over them my eyes went endlessly voyaging into that long primeval light of waking to which a child is condemned. They were archipelagos in a sea of blood-coloured varnish. They were armies grouped and united against me. They were the alphabet of a macabre tongue, the first book I ever learned to read. Radiating from that house with its crumbling walls, its thumps and shadows, its fancied foxes under the floor, I moved along paths that lengthened inch by inch with my mounting strength of days. From stone to stone in the trackless yard I sent forth my acorn shell of senses, moving through unfathomable oceans, like a South Sea savage, island-hopping across the Pacific. Antennae of eyes and nose and grubbing fingers captured a new tuft of grass, a fern, a slug, the skull of a bird, a grotto of bright snails. Through the long summer ages of those first few days I enlarged my world and mapped it in my mind, its secure havens, its dust deserts and puddles, its peaks of dirt and flag-flying bushes. Returning, too, dry-throated over and over again to its several well-prodded horrors. The bird's gaping bones in its cage of old sticks. The black flies in the corner, slimy, dead. The dry rags of snakes. And the crowded, rotting, silent, roaring city of a cat's grub-captured carcass. Once seen, these relics passed within the frontiers of the known lands to be remembered with a buzzing in the ears, to be revisited when the stomach was strong. They were the first tangible victims of that destroying force whose job I knew went on both night and day, though I could never catch him at it. Nevertheless, I was grateful for them. Though they haunted my eyes and stuck in my dreams, they reduced for me the first infinite possibilities of horror. They chastened the imagination with the proof of a limited frightfulness. From the harbour mouth of the scullery door I learned the rocks and reefs of the channels where safety lay. I discovered the physical pyramid of the cottage, its stores and labyrinths, its centres of magic, and of the green, sprouting island garden upon which it stood. My mother and sisters sailed past me like galleons in their busy dresses, and I learned the smells and sounds which followed in their wakes, a surge of breath, the air of carbolic, song and grumble, and smashing of crockery. How magnificent they appeared, full-rigged, those towering girls with their flying hair and billowing blouses, their white-masked arms stripped for work or washing. At any moment, one was boarded by them, bussed and buttoned, or swung up high like a wriggling fish to be hooked and held in their lacy linen.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's that time of the week again. It's time for Jeff Sparks' What's On Guide.
Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, June the 20th, and at the Prom Bar in Bristol, the Soul, R&B and Blues Brothers show band Kick the Cat will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Also on 20th of June, and at the Fleece and Firkin in Bristol, Left Side Brain will be performing, along with Riot Noise, Katana Kill and Once Under. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week the honours go to local blues rockers Alien Stash Tin. This is from their self-titled album and is a track titled Easy Road. Alien Stashkin with Easy Road from their self-titled album, which was released last year. I have some news regarding Alien Stashkin, and that is they have been confirmed to play at this year's Guildfest in Guildford. They will be appearing on Sunday 6th of July on the Surrey Advertiser stage at 3:15 p.m. For more information on them, you can check out myspace.com/AlienStashkin. Moving on to Saturday 21st of June, and at the Junction, Stipscroft in Bristol, there is a fundraiser to help save this fine music venue. Doors open at 1 p.m, entry is £5 on the door, and you can expect sets from the likes of the John Evistic Experience, Sam Braithwaite, Stanley Forbes and Emily Breeze, among many others. Also on 21st of June, and at the Folk House in Bristol, Acker Bilk and Friends will be performing. Doors open at 7 p.m, and entry is £7 on the door. Finally, on 22nd of June, and at the Old Duke in Bristol, the Eddie Martin Band will be performing. The gigs will start around 9 p.m, and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening, and have a great week. Take care, and goodbye.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio Show from the centre of Bristol. Before we close, Bristol Old Vic Theatre School final year graduates are presenting The American Clock by Arthur Miller at the Redgrove Theatre in Clifton. The show finishes this Saturday, the 21st of June, and all shows start at 7:30 p.m, and tickets are available on the door. So don't miss this great show, which has had excellent reviews. With us in the studio today was Helen Richardson from the Bristol and Somerset Energy Efficiency Advice Centre, the actor Malcolm Grieve, features by reporters Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. What's On was by Jeff Sparks, studio engineer was Willis Chitrakurran, the interviewer was Matt Heap, who also presented his satirical look at the news. This show was sponsored by The Converging World, an organisation that uses profits from wind turbines to set up more turbines and also to fund the work of established Indian sustainable development agencies. You can contact them at info@theconvergingworld.org. The presenter of this week's show was myself, Lisa Braden, and the producer was Anthea Page. Goodbye and have a good week.